Well, you know, we're always asking ourselves when we do interviews with public people like artists or activists or people who've been in the newspapers, what are we bringing to the radio waves that's different from, say, an NPR feature or Terry Gross? Except that the people we're talking to are usually a bit more obscure.
Well, one thing, of course, is we don't have to fill a huge amount of time, so we're only talking to people who really spark something special with us, whether or not we know exactly why.
And also, I think when I'm interviewing, the questions I ask are so blindingly simple-minded. That's one reason that we're editing. We just cut me out of the interview because you could hardly call me a penetrating, blazing intellect of an interviewer. But then people help me out by saying wonderful things. So I guess our aim is as simple as you can get, just to present really close-up portraits of people who grace the human race with all their beauty and their contradictions and their struggles and their discoveries and their fears and their courage.
Here's one, Carla Kilstead.
Carla Kilstead was a classmate of our kids in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and locally renowned there for her classical violin. Her destiny clearly was the concert stage. Now in her early 30s, we caught up with her in San Francisco with the Tin Hat Trio. And Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum. And her own songs, kind of on the far side of Laurie Anderson.
I did not go to the gym today. I forgot to read my mail today. Nothing happened. No one noticed.
And so how do you get from there to here?
I'm the second daughter of an art history professor and a fundraising consultant. Sometimes I think I got the wrong sides of both of them. And I started playing violin when I was five. I had an aunt, and she determined that I had some kind of real affinity for pitch and had perfect pitch and gave me a teeny eighth-size violin. And I don't think it had crossed anyone's mind before that. Usually you don't start making decisions about how one's life will go at the age of five. But I really, we found a local teacher and I started playing. I don't think there was any real expectation, but I really had an affinity for it. And then eventually ended up going to Baltimore to Peabody. And I went to a private school. You know, they had a practice room for me down in the basement. And so if I had a concert coming up or a competition or something or other, I could cut class and just go down and practice or go down and say I was practicing. Or I think in my case, that was a positive thing. I think it would have been harder had I gone to the public school. I think harder socially, although I had some rough moments, like sixth grade. Wow, sixth grade was just about enough for me to want to end it all. Just because girls are mean. Girls are just mean at that age. Wow. But I think even then, I basically ignored it. And at the same time, really, it saved me that I had a different community that I would interact with in Baltimore at Peabody and in summer camps when I would go to six-week music camps. And a lot of the strife that comes with that age comes with a feeling that there's a part of you that can't breathe. You know, it's difficult to get supported in a specialized kind of thing and to find, you know, an anchor for your personality. And I think music really was that for me. And by this point, I was studying with some really, really great teachers, namely Burl Sinofsky, who was a professor at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore. And he really taught me first and foremost about sound. I thought that I was pretty hotshot violinist at that point. But I remember when I went to study with him, he stopped me from doing anything, basically, except for open strings, very slowly, for months and months. And I just remember getting so frustrated and just, why can't I play music? And just having to do open strings just, 2 hours a day, just working on understanding the weight of your arm and understanding the architecture of your fingers and just things that for an 11-year-old are like, all right, yeah, okay, I can understand the weight of my arm. Let's get on with it, But he was really insistent on that. And I remember the day that I went in and we were working on one note and all of a sudden I got the sound that was just like a richer, kind of more focused thing. And he just stopped. He was like, did you hear that? I was like, yes, I heard that. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew. And that was a real pivotal moment. By the end of high school, I was pretty clear that there was something missing for me in the path of classical music, that my heroes were all the wrong heroes. Laurie Anderson and the Kronos Quartet. And so the Oberlin Conservatory was great for me. Socially, I was involved with people that were not musicians and started working with a choreographer there and started doing some experimenting there. There are people who devote their entire lives to playing Mozart. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And in fact, the deeper you go into one thing, the more you get out of it. But man, that's kind of never who I've been. And so I saw that early enough that I think I saved myself a life of dissatisfaction and grief.
When I first went to Oakland to interview Carla, we'd gotten our dates mixed up, and I spent some time just browsing her bookshelf. There was a book by Philippe Petit, who in 1974, unauthorized, walked a tight wire between the World Trade Towers. One of her heroes, she said later. He describes the moment of putting one foot onto the wire and then the first step. Where does that come from? Carla described winning the concerto competition at Oberlin and a chance to perform with the orchestra, maybe the first big step onto the tight wire.
I won with the Beethoven Violin Concerto. And there was this violinist named Gidon Kramer, who I am a big fan of, who worked very closely with a composer named Alfred Schnittke. And Alfred Schnittke wrote Gidon Kramer some cadenzas for the Beethoven Violin Concerto. And the cadenza is the moment in the concerto where the violinist could take the themes of the piece and really play with them on his own and go crazy and do whatever. And sometimes they were written out, sometimes you would improvise them, and that has really stopped now that we have recordings where you have, for every given concerto, there's one or two set of cadenzas, which are the industry standard, And I wrote Schnittke to see if he could send me his, and he wrote me this very sweet letter back saying that no, indeed, he couldn't, but good luck to you, basically. And so I wrote my own, and I think it met with various reactions from the various people on the faculty. Some of the more purist, real classical people were shocked and maybe just short of appalled. And some of the composer faculty were like, yay, go, someone in the violin performance world is stepping out. So, and this shouldn't be a revolutionary act to play your own cadenzas. I always feel a little like, for me, it was a defining moment, but it really shouldn't have been. Like, everyone should be doing this. And it was terrifying because we're not taught the skills to do this. So I really, I hemmed and hawed and spent a lot of anxious nights writing this thing. And of course, you have to write in a language which makes sense to you. So although the themes would come from the composer, the language that I ended up using was a much more dissonant language than Beethoven ever would have used. When I was like, okay, how do I mix? How do I stretch this world that I'm in to keep it really scintillating for me? And it was one of the first times in my life where I really got consumed by a working process, that I literally would wake up at 5 a.m. with a new phrase in my head. Like, oh my gosh, I just solved that in my sleep. And that's bliss, man. If you can get there like once a year, like...
Thank you. After college, she moved to San Francisco for her identity crisis.
I decided that I had been a classical violinist all my life, and that perhaps I would disappear if no one knew I was a classical violinist. And so I think more out of insecurity in some way. A combination of insecurity and defiance that's the very specific to that time of life, I think. I was like, okay, well, what if I stop? What if I'm not a classical violinist? Then who am I? So I had a rough kind of couple years and then started to just put myself in every kind of context I could find, kind of approaching music from the exact opposite angle instead of looking at music on the page and interpreting it, going into gigs having with absolutely no rehearsal and absolutely no music and seeing what happened. I started playing with a lot of really wonderful players. It was a very different kind of person, a very different kind of community. So that, you know, was all very eye-opening and ear-opening to me.
I asked, how did your parents respond to this? More than a change in career orientation, almost a change in identity.
You know, I think in a way they were relieved. I'm lucky to have incredibly supportive parents. And that's a dangerous thing when there's a certain amount of investment there that they have. But I think as one of the great things that came out of my driving so far every week for lessons with my mother was that we had to spend at least 3, sometimes 6 hours in a small car together every week. So we really learned how to communicate well. We had to. I think that is why our friendship now is so good, because we spent all those years together in the car. I think they really believed that I would find my voice in whatever way I needed to. So I didn't really feel a whole lot of, you know, pressure from them, like, you're doing what? Well, that's no kind of music. Like, why don't you get an orchestra job?
Besides local work, she tours with two groups. She'd just come home from a tour, and she was about to go on another tour. You don't learn much in school about living on the road.
It was one of those instances where you have to be careful what you wish for, because it then comes true. There was the beginning of the year, 3 years ago or 3, 4 years ago, I said out loud, and if you say it out loud, you're really in trouble, what I really want to do this year is I actually want to tour. And a year to the day, I looked back and was like, oh my gosh, I haven't been home since I said that, basically. I've never been a great, like, vacation traveler. And so this was a great way to go to a different country or a different town, and you get to look around and you get to do what you're best at, and you automatically have a local person in that town who shows you around and meets you at the train station, or, you know. So it is, and I feel really lucky to have been able to do it. And there are some people that we've met that have been real consistent friends, have become friends, site-specific friends for us that we're not necessarily in touch with outside of tour. But there are some people whose lives you get to step into, and you get to, like, stay in their houses and look at their book collections, and, you know, the people who will cook us the most unbelievable meals, and they'll plan to cook us these fabulous meals on the day of our arrival into town. And just some of those relationships and just those glimpses into other people's lives and other parts of the country have been really, really amazing. And, you know, people offer up what they can. But, man, there are some nights when someone's like, we're such big fans. We love your band. Come over to our place afterwards. You can sleep in the living room. You can take a shower. And you show up, and it's like a punk rock dungeon where the shower curtain used to be clear, and now it's like green and yellow with fungus and moss. And like the toilet doesn't drain. And you're like, you know, there is a kindness in this gesture, but it somehow feels more like torture. I think I was the first one out of the bus to go into this house, and I kind of crawl up under this porch really tired, and I was sick at that point on tour. And I go up on this rickety old porch, and this kid peers through the curtains and just looks at me with the most horrified expression and just leaves and doesn't come back for 10 minutes. And then like 10 minutes later, his friend is like, "That was Carla from Sleepy Time. Oh my gosh, that was Carla from Sleepy Time." And like opens the door. "We're so sorry. We just thought you were a homeless person, like looking to use our bathroom." I was like, "Well, I kind of am." So yeah, there's some not so glamorous sides to touring. Traveling across this country is a healthy mix of total beauty and absolute suburban decimation. And it gives you a clearer picture of the bigger trends of our society to be able to really travel it by road as much as we do. And there are some really rewarding parts of that and some thoroughly devastating parts of that.
When we toured heavily, we always got asked, "Well, do you have a life? How can you find time for doing the laundry and having relationships and this and that? How does doing all that stuff fit in with just living?"
I think a lot of people come from the perspective of having their work be separate from their home life, or their work be separate from their relationships or their social life. And for a lot of artists, I think you just can't draw that line. Most of my friends are indeed people I work with. Like, it's all for work and it's all for life. There's just no way. I think some people don't like touring because it's difficult on your relationships if you have relationships with people that don't come from the same mentality or who need more actual time together. Speaking with my mother was really interesting about this. She said to me, "You're in the first generation of women for whom a relationship doesn't have to be primary and who can really make decisions around their careers in a really serious way and not be ostracized or not be looked upon in a conflicted way." And I think she's really right. I never really worried about it. For many years, I didn't have relationships that worked. Then the man came along that I absolutely fell head over heels in love with, and we're making it work, partly because he also happens to be an absolute fabulous drummer, so I actually get to tour with him. But I think I also just have a more malleable idea of what my life can be. And if he hadn't come along, I think I would have been okay for a little while longer. Maybe forever, you know?
So I asked her, "What are the questions you ask yourself?"
Yeah, but I think for me the conflict that I come back to now and again is how much to let my own personal path still be linked to the violin, like the little box of wood that I have with a stick and a bunch of hair on it. Like, what is that? That's very bizarre. It's like my whole body's been molded around it, and I have this scar on my neck from it, and my right finger is bent backwards from the bow. Like, in some ways, I'm very much formed around this box, and that's both a beautiful thing and a very limiting thing. And the very reason it's limiting is the very reason it's beautiful. And so maybe I'll, check back in a bunch of years and maybe I will have burned it and be trying out something totally new, or maybe I will have thrown everything else away.
In Oakland, California, we were talking with Carla Kilstead. You can tune into the Tin Hat Trio at www.tinhattrio.com or Sleepytime Gorilla Museum at www.sleepytimegorillamuseum.com. And there's an unofficial Carla Kilstead website at www.kilstead.net, and you spell that K-I-H-L-S-T-E-D-T.
Websites are us. And special greetings to Carla's mom and dad, Andrea and Tico, who were great friends and supporters back in the ancient days of our sojourn in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.